From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Tim Marshall is my guest. He's a journalist, broadcaster, and the author of several books, including his latest, Prisoners of Geography, 10 Maps That Explain Everything About the World. Tim Marshall, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Greetings, and thank you very much.
Your book describes how geography has shaped our history and our destiny. Human life began in Africa, and yet modern industrial civilization began in Europe. How does geography explain that?
For this one, I have to pay tribute to the Jared Diamond book, Guns, Gems, and Steel, which laid out this thesis. I then put a lot of maps in, and used other geographic measures to talk about Africa. But the basic theory is that the ideas that were crossing east to west, west to east, across from, say, China into Europe, back and forth, it was very hard for them to penetrate downwards, southwards, through the Sahara Desert, across the Sahel region. There's 2,000 miles without water. And vice versa, of course, the ideas of the south of Africa could not penetrate through that desert going north. And so, in that sense, Africa was cut off. And the other way is that the coastline of Africa is very smooth, well, relatively smooth. And so it doesn't have deep water ports. You look at an outline of Europe, and it's got jagged areas which suggest deep water ports. Africa has very few, and so always had a problem with international trade. Europe's rivers, like the United States rivers, most of them, especially the Mississippi Basin, are flat, so you can trade along them. Africa's rivers tend to be not so flat, you know, coming from very high ground, cascading down. So all these geographic measures militated against Africa really coming out and equaling the rest of the world in its technology. Although modern technology now is creating more of a modern playing field, but I still say people are prisoners of their geography, but the technology bends those bars a little bit.
So even in modern times then, when developing nations are held back because they got started later or because they were colonized by Europe or what?
Well, again, Africa is a good example of this because it's all three. The ideas didn't help because it didn't swap. The coastline didn't help because of trade, the rivers, as we've said. Things such as beasts of burden, like the horse, find it very difficult to exist in especially the central third of Africa because of all the diseases there. And so, it's harder to trade. Then you add on something like colonization, where what wealth there was pretty much just taken from the center and headed straight out to the coastline to try and meet the European ships that were out there, and to a lesser extent the Arab ships, and take that wealth away. You could make a similar argument on the latter point about Latin America as well. You know, you look at some of their capital cities, and their capital cities, all the trade links simply went from the capitals straight down to the coastline to get the stuff out, as opposed to developing internal trading areas that hopefully would have come up. And so they really are, Latin America, but much more Africa, they really are starting from behind and playing catch up.
We're chatting with Tim Marshall, and he's just written this book called Prisoners of Geography, 10 Maps That Explain Everything About the World, and I have a million questions more, but let me ask you this. How did you get interested in this? How did you start looking at maps in a different way?
Bosnia, the Bosnian War. It's almost ancient history now, but it's the mid-90s.
Uh-huh.
And I was covering it as a correspondent. And, you know, you'd see what looks like mindless violence, you know, the tanks shelling a village. It's just like random explosions. But commander after commander would coldly explain to me the brutal logic of what they were doing. Say, look, if we take this village, then we can push people out and we can take the next village, which is on the high ground, once we've got that, we can dominate this valley. When we dominate this valley, the enemy won't be there, and that leads to a motorway. We need access to that motorway. Stuff like that. And almost every time, it was about the lie of the land and why. I mean, I suppose it's always been like that, but I hadn't thought of it in those terms. And the more I looked at it, the more every conflict was pretty much the same. And so I just became fascinated by it. And I've never argued that it is the determining factor of history. I'm arguing it is the overlooked determining factor of history, because a lot of people, especially intellectuals, don't like the idea that our fate is determined. I simply argue that as well as the great ideas, as well as the great leaders, as well as technology, you've also got to look at the geography to understand why any nation acts the way it does.
Well, on that level, what about democracy, which has flourished in North America, but much of the Middle East and Asia, not so much? Why geography, and what role does that play in the existence of democracy?
I think that's less what I'm arguing. I mean, before I come to that, let me give you a classic example of how it does determine.
Okay.
The flatlands in front of Russia, people kept invading Russia across those flatlands. Sweden, Poland, the British, the Germans twice, the French, the Turks. And so they, over the centuries, sought absolutely to dominate that flatland, which explains why Russia has always pushed forward westward. I mean, when it did it in the USSR, that was slightly ideological, but it was also about Mother Russia defending itself, albeit in an aggressive way. So that's what I mean by the classic example. You've introduced culture into this, but of course geography does partially shape culture. So if you're talking about the United States, what went across to the States and colonized it was a technologically advanced system with the basis of democracy in it, which of course had grown up in Europe through the centuries, through basically mostly fighting each other and arriving at certain systems of government. And so that was then introduced into America. But the one of the key determining geographic factors, I would argue, in the States is that because those ideas were then introduced, and forgive me, especially the British ideas, and the French, liberté, equality, fraternity, then the land, once it was colonized, was given out to people in a then democratic manner. I mean, you know, this is a difficult subject because, of course, the land was taken, but once it was taken, it was distributed amongst people, and that gave them a stake in the country, because that was done in a relatively democratic manner. And you juxtapose that with what happened in Latin America, where the Spanish came, and they had far fewer advanced democratic ideas than the French and the British. And they simply took the land and kept it for huge, huge landowners and never parceled it out. And that also, I would argue, using the land in that manner has restricted Latin Americans' growth.
What about Mexico? Can you shed some light on the situation there?
Well, one of the most fascinating thing about Mexico for me was, because I haven't studied the history, was after the Louisiana Purchase, the United States found itself with a potential enemy, Mexico, just about 100 miles from its greatest port, New Orleans. And it could not allow that, so it pushed the Mexicans back across Texas and below the Rio Grande. So what you now have for the United States is a bit of a buffer zone. A, you've got the river, which is, you know, it's not that good a defensive canal, if you like, but it is a buffer zone. And then you've got the desert. So that gave them a level of protection. Then the Mexicans themselves had the geographic problem of the Sierra Madre, these two long mountain, well, it's one mountain chain, but it's a two-pronged, coming down the middle of the country. It's hard to trade across from mountain zones. They also had this desert to cross before they got up to the richer United States. And that also has held them back. Again, technology is now bending those bars of that prison. But, you know, I mean, I think I opened the USA chapter with it's the best piece of real estate in the world. It's got great neighbors. And it's got great neighbors because they don't threaten you. The Canadians are on the Canadian Shield, rock and ice. Very few people live up there. You've got these great neighbors below. You've got this desert between you. What a fantastic piece of real estate you guys have got.
We took it away from you.
Yeah, well, give it time. We'll be back.
Well, what about Great Britain? I mean, it's pretty small, and yet, you know, for at least a good portion of its history, it was amazingly powerful.
Yeah. Well, again, it's not a bad piece of real estate, the United Kingdom. Firstly, we have that little strip of water between us and continental Europe, which has a huge psychological effect on the British, thinking of themselves as an island race, and island races tend to be fairly tough. But then you've got things like, we have got a lot of trees. Now, let me mention Egypt, not a lot of trees. So in the 16th century, when Britain, in this excellent place to A, cut down a lot of trees and make a fantastic navy, and B, get straight out there onto the sea lanes of the world, C, reasonably good rivers, fantastic farmland with which to grow and therefore become wealthy, fewer revolutions, fewer wars than were happening on the continent. And you put the whole thing together, and this relatively small island becomes this amazing world empire, partially, again, because of the geography. Egypt, meanwhile, if you look back at the 15th, 16th century, even if they had chosen to compete with the Europeans who were now moving out into the world, they couldn't have built the sort of navy that the Europeans could build because they simply didn't have the trees. So again, a geographic factor restricted them.
When the United States was born, you know, we were just a few colonies on the east, and then we kind of swept across the continent, kind of, you know, committing genocide against the Native Americans, and we got away with it. Nobody tried to stop us or anything, except the Native Americans. But when Japan tried to do the same thing to China, we stopped them, essentially. Why didn't they do it? Did they just do it too late? Should they have done it 100 years earlier?
Well, they did occasionally try. The Japanese, I mean, they did sweep across. And in fact, had it not been for the United States, if they had not pushed too far, as in Pearl Harbor, I don't think that they would have been pushed out, not for a very long time, because they did sweep across the entire area, Manchuria, large parts of China, large parts of East Asia, and it was only, and they pushed the British out, remember, and it was only when they went too far, and the Americans then lily-padded across the Pacific, you know, in total war, that it pushed them back. But there's another thing, actually, about it just reminded me about geography. The Americans now pushed it back across the Pacific a very, very long way. But had they not had Hawaii and Guam, that would have been much more difficult for them to do, because it's very important where you have what I call concrete. If you've got the concrete, you can lily pad and project your power forward. If you haven't, you're in a difficult position. Another example is an awful small war that the British had in 1982 down in the Falklands. We still have this thing called Ascension Island, which is halfway between the UK and Argentina. If we had an aircraft carrier which led the assault and took back the Falklands, but if we had not had Ascension Island on which to resupply, get the fuel, bring in everyone and get them all ready, I don't think we could have done that operation. So, you know, geography determined, partially, the outcome of the Falklands War, as it does in so many wars.
Were you surprised that Margaret Thatcher wanted the Falkland Islands? I mean, why didn't she just go, okay?
That's because you're dealing with an island nation. I mean, I don't wish to sound too nationalistic, I'm not, but... Uh-huh. Well, there was more to it than that. It was also, there is an element of bloody-mindedness and democracy. Now, I'm not defending Mrs. Thatcher or praising her, but she was a conviction politician. I mean, there's another theory that she wasn't doing too well in the polls, and so a nice little war never does any harm. if that's the case, it was a hell of a gamble. But no, the people of the Falkland Islands, all 2,000 of them, under British jurisdiction, speaking English, looking back to the motherland, 1,999 of them did not want to be ruled by an Argentinian dictatorship, and the British said, you're not going to be, we're going to come over there and we're going to rescue you. And that there really was, you can call it the last gasp of empire if you want, but there really was a strong feeling of doing the right thing. And Thatcher, for all her ills, had this strong idea of doing the right thing, certainly what she thought was the right thing. But like I said, you know, we couldn't have done that. We could have done that if it wasn't for Ascension Island.
We're talking with Tim Marshall, and his new book is called Prisoners of Geography, 10 Maps That Explain Everything About the World. He's got a website called thewhatandthewhy.com. And I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. What about, I don't know, can you talk a little bit about terrorism and about ISIL and the situation that we're in now? And can your maps lend any, shed any light on this situation?
Well, yes. Gary, I'll be honest with you, your questions are fascinating me because, and forgive me, they're great. they're challenging because most stuff we've been talking about when I've done media over here has been like, you know, the physical things such as the Himalayas separating India and China and basically preventing them from getting at each other.
Right.
Or Tibet being a high ground where the water comes from and it feeds China's mountain rivers, so China's never going to let go of Tibet, stuff like that. These are interesting and challenging questions. So I've just bought myself a minute to think while I was talking there. And what I've come up with is that, this is something I believe anyway, I've worked out. If you look at Iraq and Syria, contiguous pieces of land, which for centuries people living there would hop on a camel, wander off for 300 miles, trade with a tribe that comes from the same ethnicity as them, speaking the same language, intermarrying, and then along comes a European and tells them, actually, you can't do that anymore. A, there's a border, you lot of this and you lot of that. And they all thought, what? Are you kidding? You know, it's because some local came along and told them that. And they said, well, who said that? Oh, some bloke in Europe. And it was always a nonsense. They tried to make a good fist of it, creating these countries. But it wasn't built on geography. And Spain is the shape it is because it's got the sea below it, it's got a river separating it from Portugal, and it's got the Andes Mountains separating it from France. It makes geographic sense that space eventually became one nation state, although it is actually cracking a little bit, but put that to one side. When you look at the geographic region of Iraq and Syria, it just didn't make sense. And so when the dictatorships, the lid was taken off, which was suppressing the natural space, immediately things started to go wrong. And into that cauldron has now been injected this jihadi Islamic State philosophy, which has taken advantage of the fact that the cauldron is now, well, it's boiling, I'm afraid, now. It will end up probably in a federal states, because that is the natural geographic makeup. Iraq is a better example than Syria, but Syria is very complicated, wouldn't take another hour. But when the Turks ruled Iraq, or what the region we now call Iraq, they saw it as three separate vilayats, areas. There was the mountainous Kurdish speaking and cultural region at the top. In the middle, there was the flatland dominated mostly by the Sunni, and down the south there was this area which was mostly Shia Muslims, and they saw that very clearly and they governed it like that. And then the British came along and told these three distinct people that they were all one. You know, it's not really that surprising that it has crumbled, and as I said, into that space you will get revolutionary ideas.
Well, you know, we took Hawaii, you mentioned Hawaii earlier, and we sort of did the same thing to the Hawaiian people, where we said, well, your religion isn't your religion anymore, and your government isn't your government anymore. And yet they didn't have such a similar reaction. I'm sure there's a Hawaiian movement, but it's not like one like that. Is there something about the people in the Middle East, and can that be explained in any way by geography, why they're the way they are?
I think less so. I mean, you delve partially into philosophy the further back you go, and that's hardly empirical or provable. But there is an idea that the whole idea of one God came because, you know, you had a lot of time to look up at the stars, whereas us lot in Europe with our different gods, you know, it was usually cloudy. I digress rather a lot there.
That's all right.
No, I'm not sure about being geographic. I think that is to do with more with history and religion. And if the whole space was colonized, and then once colonization was kicked out, they tried various systems. They tried the strongman. They tried pan-Arab nationalism. They tried even a bit of Islamism with the Iranian revolution, which, you know, hasn't gone particularly well for the people. And they are, where do you go? And so also, who do you blame? And you certainly don't blame yourself, often in Arab culture, I'm afraid. And so along comes these people with these simplistic answers that there's a chant that goes up sometimes amongst some of the hardline Islamists in Europe. Europe is a cancer, Islam is the answer. Well, neither of those things are true, but I understand why some of those young, disaffected people feel that way, because they have been given an answer to their problems. And so you magnify that across a large part of the Middle East, and it's, this is the answer. If only we could turn back to having the one God the way we were when we were the massive power, you know, of the basic, the various dynasties of Islam, you know, I mean, with the poetry and the music and the mathematics and the science that they introduced. Yes, that was then, and we need to get back to them. So, you know, that, I don't think that's particularly geographic. The geographic factor comes in when the borders start to break down and the chaos ensues, and then you inject those ideas into the chaos.
We're talking with Tim Marshall. His new book is called Prisoners of Geography, 10 Maps That Explain Everything About the World. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Talk a little bit about Korea, because that's a pretty interesting one. You were saying the way they drew the line, the parallel was kind of arbitrary, but turned out to work against us.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm back on safer ground now, Gary, so thanks.
Okay.
I mean, it's an artificial line, the 38th parallel, because if you look geographically at Korea, to the right of the map, it is much more mountainous and hilly, and to the left, it's much more of the flat ground, and most of the people live towards the left. You know, if you really had to divide it, you might do it like that, but it wasn't. And this was entirely due to the geopolitics of the time, where you know, the Americans stopped at the 38th parallel because that was pretty much the agreement they had with the Chinese, which pretty much was based on a previous war with the Russians earlier in the century. So this is another artificial line. The geography of Korea is also interesting. If you look at that line, you see that just behind it in the north, it begins to get a little bit hilly across a lot of it. It's not mountains, but it's hills. And into those hills, the North Koreans have dug thousands and thousands of artillery pieces, which would take even the might of the United States 2 or 3 days to dig out from the air and ground. Now, if they've got thousands and thousands of those artillery pieces and they decide to fire them all at once towards Seoul, the capital, 25 million people, some of which will even reach the center of Seoul, you can imagine that you're talking about a catastrophic first couple of days with potentially hundreds of thousands of deaths. So that geography doesn't half concentrate people's minds. And everybody is aware that, you know, when they get towards a hair trigger, this could happen. Now, nobody thinks that the North Koreans would win a war, but look at the damage they would inflict. And so that geographic factor, where they stopped, and the fact that there's hills just above it, and that they were within range of Seoul, really affects the entire entire situation and makes everybody dance around it and think, please, let's not get this wrong. You also look at the geography further up of where North Korea's nuclear stations are. In the event it implodes, you have a geographic challenge to get to those places, because do the Americans and South Koreans cross the border in the event of the country imploding, race up north and secure all that nuclear material? Or do you let the Chinese cross the Yula River from the top and come down and get it? I mean, these are difficult decisions based on geopolitics and on the physical geography of the place. God willing, they will all come to a happy agreement, but at the moment it doesn't look that way.
So you think that our world leaders need to take closer looks at maps?
Yes, I do. I don't think that people look enough, including the world leaders. The military tends to, because, you know, let's face it, 6,000 years ago, if you were living in, well, it wasn't caves, they're not, 30,000 years ago, if you're living in a cave, and you know some other guys across the river are doing something similar, you will seek the high ground. You want to have a good look at them, and if you want to throw rocks at them, you want to throw them from a high ground. Things really aren't that different. I mean, for example, conceptually, space is the new high ground. You know, you cannot let other people dominate it. This is the geopolitics of fear. You know, this is not a particularly optimistic view. I think it's a realistic view, and I think there are ways of beating these geographic challenges, which is by cooperating with each other. But I think they are truisms of human nature, which is why, you know, the Chinese and the Americans and others are now seeking to dominate the high ground of space. And I don't think our leaders know quite enough. My real audience, though, is fellow journalists and the general reading public, because I don't think it is explained to people enough. And when people explain a situation, they will talk about the dynamics of the culture of the leader of that nation and what he or she thinks and what drives them. But they don't talk enough about the partially ironclad factors of geography. I mean, again, back to safe ground for me. Russia is by far the clearest example. If your ports freeze for some of the year and you want to be a great power, you need a navy every single day of the year, not only 6 months of the year. Consequently, if your only warm water port is in Crimea, in Sebastopol, which is on lease to you, and that country switches sides, comes into the Western sphere of influence, you have no choice. You will invade Crimea and take Sebastopol. And I remember saying this to some people at the British Foreign Office, and they, people saying, oh, he wouldn't dare. And I said, this is an existential question for the Russians. Of course they will dare. And for that, you know, you read history, you look at the geography, and you think, what would you do in that circumstance?
Well, you explain it pretty well in this book. It's called Prisoners of Geography, 10 Maps That Explain Everything About the World. The author, my guest, Tim Marshall. Thank you for bearing with all of my questions.
Well, no, thank you for asking them and challenging me. Thanks.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Tim Marshall. His book, Prisoners of Geography, 10 Maps That Explain Everything About the World. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.